Financial Times guides you through complex issues. In divisive times, don't settle for black and white. When you need the full perspective, turn to FT.com. Become a subscriber today. Search for FT subscription.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast, episode 761. It's the 19th of April, 2017. On the podcast today, I have Robin Young, CEO of AMI Minerals. That's AMC. And Robin gives us an update on the final access road to the Kunmany project in Far East Russia. Also on the podcast, Neil Ricketts, CEO of Vesarion, that's VRS, talks about the progress they're making in the world of graphene. Very interesting developments there. And if you know nothing about graphene, have a listen. It's very impressive. Also, Bonnie Hughes from Northland Capital Partners talks about Base Resources, Kenmare Resources, and Savannah Resources. Plus, I also have, as always, the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs on the platform this morning.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Robin Young, CEO of AMI Minerals. That's AMC ticker. Robin, thank you for joining me.
Thank you. I appreciate your time. Thank you very much, Justin.
No problem. We've got some news out, and we'll get to that in a bit, Robin. First and foremost, for people not aware of what you do at AMI, can you explain what the company is all about, please?
We're a nickel-copper sulfide exploration company located in the Russian Far East. We've been exploring a large-scale deposit now for over 10 years and are in the process of compiling engineering works to take this through to a production decision and the ultimate development into one of the world's largest mining operations, and possibly making us placing us among the top 10 nickel producers in the world.
Wow. And so timeline-wise, can you, spell out when this is likely to happen, going from, exploration to development to production, please, Robin?
Basically, from today, we're looking at about 4 years into production. This would include the engineering design and construction phase, which would be a four-year period. And then, of course, going into production, where there's probably about a 3 to 6 month lag on getting revenues generated due to the generation of a concentrate that would have to be transported into an Asian market and sold onward from there.
Excellent stuff. Okay, so you announced today that you've got an access road update. Take us through, because you are, like I said, based in the Far East of Russia, and take us through the significance of this road update, Robin, and what it means for you and the company there.
The road is a key component of the project itself. It's going to cost us about 30% of our total capital. And at this point in time, we're estimating the total capital to range from about $470 to $620 million. The road would be about $150 to $160 million of that. The road itself will be a gravel surfaced road, and we will own the road. So any other companies that would be in the area who would be utilizing it would be treated as a toll. It would be treated as a toll basis. Any of the local residents that would be nearby that would access the road, of course, they would have free access, and we support their villages and any infrastructure that would go along with it.
Yeah, yes. But so any business that need to use it, then you could generate revenue from that as well.
Yes. What we're seeing out there right now is there are timber companies and other mineral resource companies that are conducting exploration. As we develop the road, this will make their projects a bit more viable. And should they require use of the road, transport of supplies and materials, obviously we can strike a deal with them and allow them to continue on, take advantage of the road, at the same time generating revenues for ourselves for that transportation.
Yeah, yeah. And as far as this road is concerned, where are you in regards to the design of this and the funding of this? At what point are you on the timeline here?
It's a three-phased approach that we're taking right now. What will happen during the first phase, it will be started on a computer with 3D software, and the road will be designed from the rail siding to the mine site itself. After that road design work is done, we'll actually put boots on the ground where we'll have teams go out and inspect the exact route and make any final adjustments into that to account for geological hazards. Maybe there's a fault that needs to be taken into account, or a landslide, or we have to move a bridge further upstream or downstream. So at the end of phase one, we'll have a preliminary design that where the final route is selected. We will have a preliminary set of preliminary capital costs and operating costs to running the road. And at that point in time, then we will be able to identify the actual geomechanical the geomechanical and geotechnical aspects that we need to take into account, like soil stability and everything, during phase two, and end up with the final designs and then initiate construction in phase three. So using a three-phased approach, we'll be able to report as we advance through each one of the stages. It will be obviously, as I've said, a phased approach.
Yeah, and if everything works out the plan, when will construction start, and when do you hope to complete on this road?
We're anticipating construction starting out at about 2 years. It's also going to depend a bit on seasonality. When we start, there could be a 2 or 3 month slide based on whether we're in a summer where the taiga is a bit of a problem, or we're in deeper snows. But we're looking at, say, a 2 year period to start a construction and 2 years to completion.
Excellent stuff. And as far as the funding for this, where's that coming from?
The funding for this, it will be a part of the construction loan itself. As I had remarked earlier, we were looking at a capital cost of about $470 to $620 million. The road component is about $150 to $160 million of that, as we estimate at this point in time. That will become a part of a consortium funding package for the actual payment of the road and the construction itself. As for engineering and design work, we're funding that right now.
Okay, excellent stuff. Okay, so as far as you're concerned, Robin, you're very happy what's happening right now, and are things heading in the right direction there?
Yes, I'm very pleased. I'd also just like to add a simple comment that in the construction of all these maps and everything that we're going to be using going forward, there were over 1.5 billion data points that were processed in order to get our information set up. So it was an excellent, hard effort by the team to develop these very specific topo maps and hydrological maps. So we're, you know, the team itself has progressed well, and we're looking forward to starting to work with one of two Russian road design groups who are qualified to do the engineering design work, the geotechnical work, and also the construction.
Yeah, and in fact, it's probably worth mentioning here. So you're in discussions with the Far East and Baikal Area Development Fund. So where do they fit into this? Can you explain a bit more about that, please, Robin?
Yes, the Far East Development Fund is a part of infrastructure development in the Russian Far East. They include in their plans the development of roads, power, social infrastructure for the benefit of the residents and local people. And as a result, our road will open up a vast region. In fact, the entire northeast region of the Amur Oblast, allowing for additional jobs to be created and for additional industries to be supported, such as the timber and mining industry. So we're looking forward to working with the Far East Development Fund as we advance the project. They would become a logical partner for assisting during the construction funding phase. It would be a part of the package. Also, the fact that we're looking at using UK fabricated bridges, should they reach a component of 20% of the total cost, we can also derive additional funding from the UK Export Finance Division of the UK government. And these are both low interest rate loans. So both these organizations could work together in helping to fund the $160 to $150 million requirement for that construction.
Marvelous. Okay. Well, listen, Robin, if someone's listening to the podcast right now and they're thinking it seems to be going in the right direction, I like the sound of this, but they're not following you, could you give us three reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page, please?
Well, once we're in production, we're going to be among the top 10 nickel producers in the world on an annual basis. And that's a pretty strong position. And at that point in time, we would consider using the word world-class mine. We're also a sulfide generator, and that product, we are located in within very close distances of the three largest nickel consumers in the world, which are Japan, South Korea, and China. And all our technology is off the shelf. It's classic technology that's been used for years with flotation, crushing, grinding, open pit mining, underground mining. There's nothing new. There's nothing that has to be cracked to make this project a success. And we also are very pleased with the support that we have from the Russian government in the Far East, the state levels, the local levels. Everybody is quite keen to advance the project as quickly as possible to enhance the employment and the revenues allocated to each of the states that would be derived from taxes.
Marvellous, Robin, good to chat to you, and hopefully speak again soon. Thanks very much, Robin.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Neil Ricketts, CEO of Versarin. That's VRS ticker. Neil, thanks for coming on.
Thank you very much, Justin. Always appreciate the opportunity.
Yes, well, listen, I know a bit about Versarin. I've written a blog on you guys, and you are in the world of graphene. This, almost sort of crazy, amazing sort of substance that everyone's saying could change the world. So I think with companies like you, you've always got to keep an eye on companies, like yourself, in that space, because you never know where it could go. It could be, even yesterday on Twitter, we saw Richard Branson. Did you see that? You retweeted quite a bit.
I actually retweeted that tweet. He's conversing with one of our partners, the University of Manchester and the National Graphene Institute. He's been getting his facts right, and he's been talking to the academics.
Yeah.
And he's very, very enthusiastic. Obviously, part of his business is focused on space travel, and space travel relies on lightweight structures, and that's what graphene delivers.
Yeah, exactly. There's so many applications for graphene, though. It's almost mind-blowing. It almost seems too good to be true. So before we get into this, though, Neil, can you give... I know there's different parts to your business, so can you give a brief summary as to what the business is all about in Versarin, please?
Sure. So we've got a slightly different business model. We've got conventional... traditional businesses that are making products for great companies like Jaguar and Tesco's and the oil and gas companies like Schlumberger. And then we've got a series of development companies, and those development companies are very much focused on new materials which are going to deliver these great opportunities in the future. And we got involved in those businesses in 2012 when we bought a spin out from the University of Manchester. And more recently, we've bought a spin-out from the University of Cambridge. So we're ideally placed to exploit this new technology.
Yeah, and like any hot sector, you always have new entrants coming into it on a regular basis, I suppose. And when I was looking around, because for a while, graphene's been on my radar, but didn't know how to sort of get exposure to it. And I was looking around thinking, right, how can I get exposure to this? And I looked into your company there, and one of the things that convinced me was that, graphene, phenomenal substance. Like I say, so many applications. It's the lightest material, it's the strongest, it's got conductivity, better than copper. And I noticed that you there have connections with the University of Manchester, specifically as well, where the guys who invented graphene. So, it doesn't get better than that, does it, as far as connections are concerned?
Oh, no, we're right there in the center of everything that's going on. So the government have invested heavily in the graphene industry that's starting to develop. £65 million investment up at the University of Manchester in the National Graphene Institute. This is a worldwide flagship, and we have access to that as part of our relationship. University of Manchester is a shareholder in our business, and they're still a shareholder in the subsidiary 2DTEC, which is pioneering a lot of this work. And we're right there in the middle of all of these massive conversations that are going on. Someone like Richard Branson wants to find out what's going on. He talks to the National Graphene Institute. And so it's really key for us to have these kind of academic links and links to companies that are trying to explore this absolutely brand new science. Graphene is a phenomenal material. As engineers, we're no different to you guys. We're absolutely staggered by this new science that's starting to appear. But these particles that we're making are 50,000ths the thickness of a human hair. That takes a bit of getting used to in your head. And there are microscopes up at the University of Manchester which are looking at these materials at a single atom, that's simply staggering. It's a brand new science. And the UK is leading the march on this.
Yeah, One of the things I watched your presentation, you said that, like I said, there are so many applications. There's also the water filtration side of it and all that that can change almost seawater or poisoned water into almost drinkable water. There's so many applications. It's knowing what to focus on. So what are you focusing on? And also, you know, how is this commercial? How will it become commercial? Because I've heard a lot of people say, yeah, we all know that the possibilities here are endless almost, but it's almost getting making the next step to commerciality. And how are you doing that?
So one of the things that we spotted, so we were very apprehensive about this new science. You know, there's always lots of money to be spent, you know, trying to develop these revolutionary type materials. And we don't get involved in that. What we get involved in is picking the technology when it's closest to commercialization. Mm-hmm. And so what we did was we formed a relationship with the guys at the University of Manchester. We did all our homework. We identified that they had a process for being able to make this material very, very cost effectively, which is one of the big keys. They also were able, we could see through our experience as a company, how we could develop that process to manufacture big volumes, you know, to scale up this technology, which is the other unlocking feature you need. And the combination of those two things means that we have a fairly unique proposition now. And the thing that's been holding back graphene development has been access to the material. So we've got an office now full of people that are out there talking to all of these big companies, you know, getting them to understand that not only do we have independently certified material, which is of a very, very high quality, we also have the ability to make it in the volumes that they're probably likely to need. And the volumes are staggering. You know, not our data, but the data from the Future Trends analysis shows that by 2025, we'll need 54,000 tons of material.
Wow. Okay.
That's a simply staggering amount of material.
Yeah, yeah. And so in areas-wise, specifically, I mean, because I know you're into sort of the print side of it, being able to print sort of almost circuitry using graphene, and there's obviously, you know, composite bodies for F1 cars or for planes like this. Which areas are you sitting in there?
Okay, so we tend to, as a company, develop a tier approach. So the tier one stuff is the stuff that's going to come into production fairly quickly. In December, we announced one of the largest orders in the world for a carbon fiber composite product. And the reason that that is so good is because it's not that disruptive. It's actually a substitution for something that's already used. It means that big companies aren't as exposed to this new technology as if it was something more radical. And so there's much earlier adoption. Now, further down the line, you know, through tier two and tier three, which are things like batteries and medical devices and some of the more elaborate things like water filtration you spoke about, they're a little bit further away. And then tier three is even further away. And that's the guys up in Manchester are working with some of the researchers on the cure for cancer, diabetes and dementia by using graphene as a drug transportation system, being able to target specifically areas in the body by getting these graphene particles to hunt them out.
Yeah,
and that's a little bit further away, unfortunately. But you know, obviously, these are not small challenges that we're taking on.
Yeah, and like I said, you are made up of several different businesses, which you know are generating revenue. So, will you be generating revenue from your graphene side of the business?
Yeah, it's growing quickly. And as I said, we've moved out of the research and development stage towards the end of last year. Where we were putting all the foundations in place, making sure we had all of the data for our customers, making sure we knew how to use these materials in applications that the customers want to use them in. And now it's all about getting out there, getting the sales of our brand new product, Nanine, which is the one that came out of the University of Manchester. And you know, more recently, that's been joined by another great acquisition out of the University of Cambridge, which is all looking at printable electronics, looking at making sensors, making smart packaging, these kind of things out of graphene on a very, very cost-effective process.
Yeah, you need to have a meeting with Richard Branson, I think.
Well, I've been trying, but he's refusing to take my call at the moment. But I will get there.
Yeah.
One thing you can say is that I never give up. So
no, good stuff. All right. So what's the next? If people are you know sort of following you now, what's the next big sort of milestone you're looking at achieving here with graphene?
it's all about orders now. It's all about, we've got products now. It's all about getting to these big companies. Unfortunately, big companies don't move as quickly as small companies like ours. You know, we're very fleet of foot. The bigger companies, they take a bit of time, but, you know, you've got to do that. So we currently have two strategies in place and two different teams. The one team are talking to the universities and the researchers, getting our material out there, making sure that it's our material that they're using. And then the other team are concentrating on these very, very large organizations and getting them to understand that even if they have tried graphene in the past, they've probably not tried the right graphene and that they need to try our graphene. And so that's our strategy. I mean, we've got something like 13 shows or opportunities for us to showcase our technology over the next 3 or 4 months. We are absolutely out there and doing everything we can to promote this this new product.
Yeah, and the thing is, I suppose, I mean, are you finding you're getting a positive response? Because, like I said, those connections you have with Cambridge and Manchester University, you know, that's, you know, there's not many companies who can boast that. But also, I mean, graphene has been sort of around and talked about as the future for a while. But are people starting to see that this may be about to happen, or we're on a tipping point here, or it's heading towards that, you know, area?
It is definitely on a tipping point. What's happened is the graphene scene has been a bit like the Wild West. Mm. Lots of people have made lots and lots of claims over the last sort of 10 years that graphene has been talked about. But what we've not been able to do is deliver good product in the quantity that people have needed to make some of these applications come reality. And so what we've got now is we've got this real big opportunity. And what we need to do is we need to focus heavily on getting to the right customers with the right information and showing them that this product is now available and that it actually works. The one thing that I'm a mechanical engineer by background, and what I always insist is that you know, if we're going to show any kind of testing at all, we need to make sure that it is independently tested and that it's not company generated data. It's not generic. It is very, very specific, and that's what's setting us up differently to everybody else that's out there.
Yeah, and so are you, last question before we get to the three reasons why someone should hit the follow button on your page, but are you, say, would you say, are one of the only companies that can produce, mass produce this high quality graphene?
Yeah, there is no doubt in my mind that we are, having done, you know, lots and lots of extensive research, having ourselves as a company, but also through our partners at the universities, and also having seen some of the test results that other people have actually generated, that we are in a very unique position as to having the ability to mass produce this material. Yeah. I don't think we'll be the only people in the world that ever produce this material. And I'd probably guess that that's probably not a healthy thing to do anyway. But what we do know is that we have a massive advantage at the moment and that we've really got to exploit that advantage.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to meet him with Richard. All right, listen. So if anyone's listening right now, they think, yes, I like the sound of this. Graphene is the future. And you're the company to follow. You know, but they haven't hit that follow button, Neil. Give them three reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page, please.
Okay, so I think that the three reasons that I would choose to follow this is that the management are extremely experienced and that we can give you the information about this sector due to the partners that we've got. We, in terms of other reasons why you'd want to follow us, I think this is probably one of the most exciting sectors currently in the UK, if not the world, and that a lot of the disruptive change will be enabled by technology like us. And the third reason is that I think that if you were to follow us, you'll see a genuine company that are trying to really change society. And we've got some big challenges ahead of us, and we'd really like to see you along on that path.
Yeah, well, I'd add another one. As an investor, I always tend to look at the shareholder register. And I know you're a big you know, holder of this company stock, so you've put your money where your mouth is, haven't you?
Well, I was going to say that, but I thought I better not say that because I've used that quite often recently. But yeah, I have a lot of skin in the game. It's in, you know, my interests are absolutely aligned to the shareholders. We treat the business as if it's our own. We are this is not a lifestyle business by any stretch of the imagination. We're also very open with our shareholders, and we'll be giving shareholders the opportunity to come and talk to the directors, to see the products, and to look at the facilities that we have access to in the very near future.
Excellent, Neil. Good to chat to you, fella, and hopefully we'll speak again soon. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Bonnie Hughes, Manager of Corporate Broking and Sales at Northland Capital Partners. Bonnie, thank you for coming on.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm looking forward to our call.
Yes, you come highly recommended, as in you know your stuff. Is that the case?
Well, you can never know all your stuff in this business because it's quite difficult.
Yeah, but it's always a learning curve, isn't it? It's always good. I mean, especially, you know, when you're investing, there's always things to learn. That's why I like the markets. You know, you're always learning. We're still, you know, sometimes you invest in a company, you think, this is going to be a 10-bagger, and all of a sudden it doesn't go anywhere. And you think, what's happened there then? And something, you know, gets released. You know, I didn't see that happening. So there's always a learning curve. So what are we talking about today, Bonnie?
We're talking about mineral sands and ilmenite. And the reason for that is I believe that last year, most of the projects that were producing mineral sands were in a slump as the prices of ilmenite and rutile were down. But I think it's going to follow the same course that gold and base metals went through a couple years ago. So right now there's some supply constraints on ilmenite. And so that has pushed prices higher. And the reason for the supply constraints is that China has been, due to their environmental concerns now, have been shutting down environmentally unfriendly ilmenite producers. And then in India, the government of Tamil Nadu has banned mineral sands mining in this Indian state. So the prices that companies have been getting for their mineral sands have increased almost 200% since middle of last year.
Wow. So why do we know why India's banned mineral sands projects or what?
I just think that they believe for environmental reasons that they're decided to ban it in that state. And that's one of the biggest producers of it in India.
Okay. All right. So who is this likely to benefit? If we're looking at, say, the junior market over here, who will this benefit, do you think?
Well, first of all, Base Resources just came out with their quarterly report just last week. Yeah. And as they said, they've been getting 200% higher for their prices. They were able to reduce their net debt. They had record quarterly rutile production, and their ilmenite production increased for the quarter to 112,368 tons versus 110,760 in the previous year. And they also have the capacity to ramp up their production going forward. So right now they have a market cap of about 153 million pounds. And, you know, I think they are going to be, the next quarter is going to be even better than the last quarter.
Okay, so that's BSE is ticker there. Not that familiar with Base Resources. Okay, who else, mineral sands? Who else dealing mineral sands then?
Well, we had Kenmare Resources, yeah. And their actual production for Q1 2017 for heavy mineral concentrate was up 29% to 353,500. For the year, they were able to reduce their loss before tax to 17 million, down from 61.9 million. So, as you can see, just like the same sort of trajectory that the base metals and gold metals companies went through, you can see that these companies are starting to reduce their costs, increase their production, and get better prices for their product. So what I wanted to do was highlight Savannah Resources.
Yeah.
Because they just came out with a very good JORC resource on their project in Mozambique, which they are in partnership with Rio Tinto. So if you're going to be in partnership with anybody, it's nice to have a big partner like Rio Tinto to help you take something forward.
Yeah.
So they just came out with basically on one of their projects a resource of 900 million tons at 4.1%. And what they found within this project is that they have a high grade portion of 92 million tons at 6.2%. So what that means is they can get more revenue quicker and faster in the beginning and start generating some cash flow when they go to mine it. So now, with all of their projects combined, which is in Mozambique, they'll have a global resource of 4.4 billion tons at 3.9%. And they are in the process of, they can still add to that as well, and they're growing it. So keep your eye on them because they have a scoping study coming out this quarter. It could be this month or next month, but I believe when you see the scoping study and you see what the economics of the project are going to be, it could be very, very interesting, because the market cap is only 25 million mm-hmm. pounds. And so if they are going to be able to get into production, which they're looking at, you know, about 200 million tons to start with, then, you know, you can watch, and they could potentially grow to either the market cap of Base Resources or something like a Kenmare.
Yeah. So there's plenty of upside there, potential there, you know, between, what, 5 and 10 times almost. And so when you see a junior miner, like you say, hooking up with a big miner like Rio Tinto, it's always worth checking out, isn't it, I think? Because, you know, the big miners don't hang around with smaller sort of explorers for no reason. There's got to be a good reason there, hasn't there?
Yes, well, Savannah is earning in their interest. So once a feasibility study is complete by Savannah, they will have a 51% interest in the project with Rio Tinto. And basically, Rio Tinto is going to be, has an off-grid take agreement with them for 100% of the production. So the reason that Rio Tinto's in there is they don't actually want to be the operators.
Yeah.
Savannah's going to be the operators, but what they want is the actual product. So this tells you that when a big guy wants your product, you know, they're willing to just go in there and let you do the operation. And so it's a really good deal for Savannah.
Yeah, absolutely. Excellent. Well, Bonnie, thanks for that. And it's, you've enlightened me on mineral sands, and I will keep an eye on. In fact, Savannah are on my watch list, so I do keep an eye on them. So thanks very much, Bonnie. Hopefully speak again very soon.
Great. Thank you very much. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at 5, SDX Energy, ticker SDX. At 4, ASA Resources Group, ticker ASA. At 3, Infinity Energy, INFT. At 2, Westminster Group, WSG. And at number 1, the most followed company, no surprise, on the podcast very soon, hopefully, Motif Bio, MTFB. All right, here are the top 5 most liked RNSs in the last 24 hours. They are at 5, 7 Digital. That's Holdings and Company. I think it's Mighton Group. They've gone above, 12 or 13%. At 4, Onzima Ventures, results of AGM. At 3, Blenheim Natural Resources, BNR, and that's redemption of convertible loan notes. At 2, Zenith Energy, ZEN, director's shareholding. And at number 1, the most liked RNS on Vox Markets platform today was from Edenville Energy, that's EDL, and that was the Rukwa Coal Project Update. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
The Financial Times guides you through complex issues. In divisive times, don't settle for black and white. When you need the full perspective, turn to FT.com. Become a subscriber today. Search for FT subscription.